Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein. This week it's post-Purim, so we're going to continue on the same theme as we did last week, which is drinking. So our first guest, we have Rabbi Dr. Abraham Twersky. He's the famous psychiatrist who's written over 60 books and Svarim. He's published for Art Scroll. He's also written many books about addiction, both with alcoholism and other substance abuse, and he's going to speak about addictions in our community and particularly alcoholism, being that we're sort of in a Purim mode. After that, we will have a halachic discussion with Rabbi Akiva Niehaus. He's a halachic expert in the kashrus of alcoholic drinks. He's the rabbinic coordinator of the CRC, and he is probably the number one expert in kosher alcohol drinks. All the new convoluted, you know, flavored beers, gins, liqueurs, etc., etc. You are listening to us either Matzah Shabbos from 11 to 12 midnight on WMCA or at 570 AM or on the Nachum Siegel Network. You can also listen to us Monday morning at 11 AM at NachumSiegel.com. You can find all our shows at headlinesbook.com under the audio or podcast section. We also have a new hotline with all our previous shows. You can call in at 732-806-8700. You can also email any questions or comments to info@headlinesbook.com. So I'd like to share with you a really wonderful thought, Purim related. You know, there were lots and lots of rules in Shushan. The word dus does not appear in the whole Torah until Megillas Esther, and then it just starts appearing again and again and again. It says, V'hashtiyah kadus ein aines. The drinking was according to the rules or according to the ethics, but they didn't force ein aines. There were rules. Rules about how to eat. Dvar ha-melech v'dasai, the words of the king and his rules. Lifnei kol yodei dus v'din, those who knew the rules and the din. V'hadas nitna b'shushan abira. Boy, they had rules, regulations, statutes, methodology. And that was gullus. Because you know what gullus is? Gullus is when we're sort of tangled up in a web, that we do things according to just roots and procedures, and we just can't seem to change at the way we look at something. You know that same argument you've been having with your spouse or your mother or your father or your kids again and again and again, and they just keep doing, or you just keep doing the same thing again and again? It's like a tire spinning in the mud. It just can't change anything, going round and around and around. That's what sometimes these rules again and again and again. And you know what Geula is? Finally, after all these rules, the same way of doing things, Esther, a very brave and courageous Esther, what does she say? Uvechein avay el hamelech, asher loy kadas, not according to the rules. I look at things a little differently. I'm going to change the prism. I'm going to reframe the situation. And what does Haman say about Klal Yisrael? Daseyem shaynais mikal am. They look at things differently. So gullus is dus, yaydei dus v'din, kedus v'ein aynes, dvar ha-melech v'dasei, v'dus nitnar, dasei parasumadei. What is gula? Asher loy kadus, uvechein avi al ha-melech asher loy kadus. When we can change the way we look at a situation, that is enlightenment, that is redemption. So let me continue this thought. Let me share with you something really beautiful. You know, the Balaturim in Tavkuf Pei Beis says something really interesting. He says on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, when we daven, we have a nusach that we don't have any other time of the year. We say, uvechein yiskadesh. If you're Sfarad, you say, uvechein tein kavod. Then you say, uvechein tein pachtecha. And then you say, uvechein tzadikim, right? You say four times or three times, Sfarad or Ashkenaz. So he says, where does this come from, this new nusach ha-tefillah? Said Balaturim, and it's also brought in the Avudraham, the great Rishon, the Talmud of the Balaturim, who lived in Sevilla in the 14th century. He says, you know where it comes from? It comes from Uvechein Avoy al Hamelech Asher Loi Kados comes from the Megillah. And let me perhaps share a thought with you. We're standing there, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, it's the beginning of the year, and we're trying to recreate ourselves, saying, this year, I'm going to create a new me. I'm going to be Yotzer, a new me, to serve, to elevate, to be. But I'm going to be different this year. Well, how am I going to be different this year? Everything I do, I'm just the same person as last year. And you know what we say? Uvechein avoy el hamelech asher loy kadas. I'm going to look at it differently. I'm going to turn that prism on myself, on my relationships, on my learning, on my job, on my avodah, on my chesed. I'm going to look at all of them in a different light, on my social relationships. And then, if we can do that, I could have uvechein avay el hamelech, I could have uvechein yiskadesh, I could have uvechein tein pachtecha, and ultimately, uvechein tzadikim. So, what do we take out of this? That there's all those rules and ruts and regulation. And what was Geula? Geula is when we can look at ourselves, our situations, and our lives and say, how do I reframe it, change the prism, look at it differently, and this time come up with a solution? That's enlightenment. That's Geula. That's the story of Esther. We are speaking to Rabbi Avram Yeshua Twersky, the famous Chassidish Rav and doctor, who's probably the most prolific author of Jewish topics in the world, to my knowledge.
Thank you.
So, Rabbi Twersky, is drinking a problem in the Orthodox community?
You know, when I grew up, I believed, like everybody else, that shikar is a goy, and that alcoholism is not a problem among Jews. And then I gradually discovered that it's a problem among Jews. And I said, yes, but it's probably not a problem among firm Jews. And then I discovered that it's a problem among firm Jews. There's no immunity. There's no discrimination. Yes, it's a problem, and it's a serious problem. And it's a particularly serious problem when we get to talk about young people.
What causes it? What should parents look out for?
Okay, in terms of what causes it, if you get the answer to that question, you're sure to win the Nobel Prize. We don't know what causes alcoholism. We don't know the causes of addiction. Certainly, there's factors in a person's life that if he's under a great deal of stress and may well look for alcohol or drugs as a tranquilizer, that's understandable. But that doesn't explain the disease. In alcoholism, we know there's a genetic factor. Children who are born to an alcoholic parent have four times as likelihood of turning out to have alcoholism as children who do not have an alcoholism parent. And that's true even though they were not raised by that parent. There's excellent studies that have shown that children who were given up at birth for adoption, if they had an alcoholic parent, they still had the same ratio. So we know that there is a genetic factor. That does not mean, though, that they're going to become alcoholic. It's just that they have a greater predilection to become alcoholic. So one of the things is, if there has been an alcoholic in your family, uncle, grandfather, whatever, be especially careful because your children may be more vulnerable. Okay? Secondly, watch for early onset of drinking. You know, sometimes if you go to a kiddush Shabbos morning, you'll see that some kids, maybe 11 or 12, hang around till after kiddush and empty up whatever is left in the little cups. Right? That's a clear sign of an alcoholic problem. It's also important to realize that alcoholism comes in several stages. First of all, there is alcohol abuse. Now, that does not mean that the person is addicted, but that he does not handle alcohol normally. And by the way, when I say he, it's just convenient for me to use that pronoun. She is as well. One would not believe that from Jewish women can become alcoholic, but it happens. So there can be alcohol abuse, which means that a person drinks excessively, maybe not regularly, excessively. People go to Shalom Zohar or to Farbrengen or whatever, and if they drink more than is appropriate, enough to give them a change of behavior, right? That is alcohol abuse. Right? If they become more aggressive, whatever, if it changes their personality, it changes their behavior, then they have to be on the lookout, and this is what parents should be on the lookout for. There's another important thing to realize. Your children, if they have an alcohol problem, will not admit it. Now, we know that yeshiva boys in some places get together Friday night, and they drink to get drunk. They will never admit it to their parents, and their parents, if they would know about it, choose not to recognize it. Right, so there's the problem of denial. We don't recognize that our kids have a problem, and we don't do anything about it. We're ashamed to admit it, and we're afraid that if we do anything about it, they'll never be able to do a shidduch. Right? That's the denial that is a serious problem. So there's alcohol abuse. Now, there's also a kind of unusual reaction to alcohol, where a person takes even one drink and his speech becomes slurred. If that happens, that means he's got extremely sensitive to alcohol and he should stay away from it. Lying about drinking is a sign that there's a problem. So when I say the kids, parents ask them, did you have any beer? No. And they find out that they did, that's an indication. If they say, yeah, I had a beer, but okay. Children should not drink any alcohol before the age of 21, except for the minimum share of Kiddush. Now, I know that's being extreme, but this is a condition that requires, like cancer, it requires extreme methods.
Even with healthy children with no history of alcohol abuse, you can't give them schnapps after the herring or anything? I mean, is moderate? Can we train our kids to drink?
Kids under 21 should not take a schnapps for any reason. The young brain is not mature enough to make decisions and to know when to stop.
What about wine? Would you say the same thing about wine?
That's what I said, to use the minimum share for Kiddush. And there's a halacha that, whether it's 2 ounces or an ounce and a half, and that's it. Right? And I think that if... the reason I say that I'm comparing it to cancer is because cancer does not begin with very severe symptoms. Cancer is usually silent, and then when the first symptom appears, it's already a problem.
Rabbi Twersky, in countries like France, children drink wine with dinner from the age of 7 and up. It's considered almost barbarian not to drink wine. Is that what you're suggesting?
Right, and they've got alcohol problems.
Tell our listeners, or share with our listeners, some of the dangers of drinking.
Yeah. If a person drinks safely, right, meaning a person has a l'chaim or two, an adult over 21, has a l'chaim or two, or drinks a glass of beer or so, and it doesn't have any unusual effect on him, that's no problem, right? If it does, then it means that his brain is sensitive to alcohol, and continued drinking is likely to end up in a problem. Now, people who drink in order to socialize, or people who drink for any reason, for example, to go to sleep. I can't sleep without a beer. Right? That's dangerous. That's not alcohol abuse. That's alcohol dependency. Right? Because you can't live without sleeping, and you can't really live without socializing. And if you have to have a drink in order to socialize or to sleep, you can be certain of one thing, and that is that after a period of time, the amount that you're taking is no longer going to be effective. So I had a fellow who was couldn't sleep, so he took a beer. Right? After a few weeks, one beer didn't do it anymore, so he took 2 beers. Make a long story short, he ended up, after a couple of years, drinking a fifth of a pint of alcohol in order to go to sleep. And he happened to be a doctor also. So if you're dependent on alcohol, then you know that it's going to increase and that you ought to avoid it. Now, that's not pleasant because people like to drink, and I hate to deny it that to them. But if you're allergic to penicillin, you can't use penicillin.
What damage does an alcohol problem do to a person?
What damage it does, first of all, it's unpredictable. Two summers ago, there was a young man from a firm family in the Catskills, right, who drove a car on Shabbos and crashed it. That would not have happened in my time. Secondly, alcohol, if taken to excess, kills brain cells. Right? Now, you can knock off some brain cells and still function normally, and there are many functioning alcoholics, but ultimately it takes its toll.
If someone has a child or a spouse with a drinking problem, what should they do about it?
Two things. First of all, don't use your own judgment about what to do. Get expert advice. Don't listen to your neighbor. Get expert advice, either by going to someone who's an expert on alcoholism, or better yet, go to meetings of Al-Anon family groups. These are husbands and wives or parents of people who have had an alcohol problem. These are the people who have lived with the problem, and they know what works and what doesn't work. It was just a little incident. It's not going to happen again. And when it happens again, it just happened. These are excuses, right? And excuses are, unfortunately, paved the way to disaster.
Right. Is it curable?
No. It's like diabetes. It can be controlled, but it's not curable. Curable means that a person who has an alcohol problem is cured, and he no longer has a problem, and he can drink safely. Now, he either has a problem or he doesn't. If he has a problem, it means his system is geared to react badly to alcohol, and it can be controlled. And I have had people who have been sober, have not had a drink for 45 years. Right? And they will talk about themselves as, I am recovering, but not recovered. Because recovered means I no longer have the problem.
So you're saying they can never have another drink while they're in recovery?
One very famous doctor says, once a cucumber becomes a pickle, it doesn't go back to being a cucumber again. Now, what I want to stress especially is the role of the family in realizing that if there is a problem, then they have to get expert advice on how to deal with it. Right? Because there are children whose behavior turns out bad. Right? And families say, I'll do something. They bribe them or whatever. Don't rely on your own judgment. Get an expert on alcoholism to help you. Or, like I said, better yet, go to the people who have had the problem in their family. They know how to deal with it. So Al-Anon meetings are crucial. And it's a good way to start off by writing to Al-Anon and getting their literature and become educated in it. Right? There's a excellent video available called L'Chaim. And it was made by the Yehuda Mand, M-O-N-D, Foundation. Right? He made that video in memory of his son, who died in driving under the influence of alcohol. And it was also injured several other people in the car. And I think it's important that parents should, that everybody should see that film video, L'Chaim. You can get it by going on the internet and looking up under the Yehuda Mand, M-O-N-D, Foundation, and get L'Chaim and see, don't belittle the problem.
In your opinion, Dr. Twersky, when I was growing up, I don't recall ever seeing a drinking problem in the Frum community. Today, it's become a problem. What's changed?
You know, it's very interesting that the Torah tells us about Noach, each tzaddik tomim hayo b'dorei, so the perfect, perfect tzaddik. And then he goes out and plants vineyards and gets drunk and acts shamefully. How does that happen to a perfect tzaddik? And the Sfas Emes said something which is so true. He said Noah used to use wine safely, and he knew how much he could drink without it having a bad effect on him. So, after the Mabul, he came out of the Teva, planted the vineyard, right? And he drank what he knew was safe for him. What he did not realize, it's no longer the same world. There had been a flood and destroyed the world. And if it's no longer the same world, you can't go by the old, by the previous rules. You have to take new rules. This is not the world that I grew up in, not the world that you grew up in. In fact, it's not even the world of 20 years ago. Right? This is a world where in 1960, the slogan was, if it feels good, do it. That is what's operating the world now. Right? People have no concept that there's anything higher than life other than having a good time. And youngsters believe that we're entitled to a good time. And if we're not having a good time, there's something terribly wrong. We've got to go get it. So they either go for alcohol or for drugs. Technology has been so wonderful that it's eliminated so many of the hardships that were there in 1930 when I grew up, right? That we have people, adults have come to believe that the world is an amusement park. Well, and therefore, there's no reason to avoid having a good time. There's no now. I am not against having a good time. I'm not against enjoying things. I just say that you have to have some better goal in life, other than if it feels good, do it. The Medrash has a beautiful thing. Medrash Tanchuma and Noach says Noach went ahead to plant in his garden. So the Sotan came along and says, "I'll help you. Right? I'll fertilize it." So he shechted, he slaughtered a lamb, and used the blood to fertilize the vineyard. Right? And then he shechted a monkey and used its blood. And then he shechted a lion and used its blood. And then he shechted a chazer, a pig, and used its blood. So the Medrash says, that tells us that if a person has one drink, he becomes as meek as a lamb. If he has two drinks, he can act foolishly like a monkey. Right? If he has three drinks, he becomes bold as a lion. And if he has four drinks, he can act like a chazer. Right? That's a medrash, right? 3,000 years ago. Right? So, I think that we have to realize that the world is not the same world that was on. Even in our own time, marijuana was a drug, an illegal drug. And now almost every state is moving toward legalizing marijuana. Right? And they'll say, well, it's no different than alcohol. It's much worse than alcohol. Because alcohol, for all of its damages, alcohol gets out of the system within a number of hours, right? Whereas marijuana stays in the brain for 3 weeks. But that's the sign of the times. If you want it, if it feels good, do it. So I'm saying that parents should not fool themselves, because we don't want to believe that our children are doing something dangerous. So he just got to say he got drunk, right? And especially with Purim coming up, right? Prominent Rosh Yeshiva of Philadelphia, Shmuel Kamenetsky, made it very clear, right, that in these days, drinking to excess and Purim, drinking to get drunk, is not a mitzvah, it's an absolute issue. Right? And I think we have to make that clear to our kids. And I think that with Purim coming up, that parents should know that when kids come to their house, that they sometimes make the rounds of the house on Purim, don't give them any alcohol. And if you give a youngster alcohol who comes to your house on Purim, you are responsible for any damage that happens to him or to others. Right? So it's a new phenomenon, and we have to be prepared to deal with it. Right? And we have to realize, just like Noach, it's not the same world that we grew up in.
Can you share with us the name of a reputable rehab facility that serves our community for alcoholism and or other addictions that our listeners can perhaps use?
Right. First of all, there's thousands of rehabs, and there are many good ones. Unfortunately, there are really, to the best of my knowledge, there is no rehab that is a prestigious, reputable rehab that is based on Yiddishkeit, whatever. Now, many of them will have, I've sent many people to rehabs, whether to my own Gateway, or to Karen Foundation, or to Father Martha's place out in Baltimore. Some of them have chaplains. They will all provide kosher food, right? They understand that a person cannot do things on Shabbat, right? But one of the reasons that there is not a absolutely firm rehab is because we're still in denial. You know, why people say, can't go to AA meetings, they're in churches. There are very few meetings that are not in churches because no shul, there are few shuls that have an AA meeting. Why don't the shuls have AA meetings? Why are they all in churches? Because we don't recognize that the problem is ours. And until such time that we recognize, if we recognize the problem is ours, then we'll get together and have a rehab there's some activity now in Cleveland of developing a firm Orthodox rehab. But as of now, there's many rehabs that accommodate an Orthodox patient, but I don't know if there's anyone that's really firm in philosophy.
Well, Rabbi Twersky, thank you for bringing this very important issue to the attention of our community. Thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.
We have the honor of having with us on the line from Chicago, Rabbi Akiva Niehaus. He's the rabbinical coordinator of the CRC. He's the author of the fantastic Sefer Scotch and Sherry Casks, which you can download online, which is truly one of the landmark works on the topic, the kashrus of alcoholic beverages. Welcome, Rabbi Niehaus.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Can we ask you a few questions about alcoholic beverages? Beers have become very popular, particularly craft beers, microbreweries. It used to be Heineken, Budweiser, like these boring, huge factory-made beers that were made like in million-gallon quantities. And now beers have become much more like, you know, personalized. So whereas the old-style beers, nobody gave a thought about it. It was just you buy them, you quaff them. They were very generic and boring. Now beers have personality. Are there kashrus issues with the new beers?
That's a great question, and you are totally correct that the beer has evolved into a very specialized industry, and what we've seen recently is the trend has been to focus on flavored beers, you know, really the crazy part. Let me give you some examples. How about the Mamma Mia pizza beer? I mean, who would have thought of making such a beer like that 20 years ago? It just didn't exist. But really, it evolved into really trace beers. The recent trends have been to create oyster stouts and clam stouts, and these are obviously trace. There is one beer on the market called the Bacon Maple Ale, and you know, that's definitely trace. So the question is going to be as follows. How does this impact the kashrus of beer? This is certainly apropos around the Pesach, around the Purim season, when we get tons of questions from consumers wanting to know guidance on beer. So for starters, let me say is that a flavored beer of any kind, whether it's trace, obviously you can avoid that, but even if it's not trace, if it's just a simple spiced beer or orange flavored beer, these should obviously be avoided due to the cautious concern of the flavorings. Where it gets more complicated is the unflavored beers. Is there any kashrus concerns there? So whenever you look at a product to determine the kashrus status, there's two things you have to look at. You have to look at the ingredients and the equipment, the kalim. So focusing on the ingredients of beer, it's very simple, and it's been like this for hundreds of years. Barley, water, hops, and yeast. And all these are definitely assumed to be kosher, and they don't really present any kosher concerns. The concerns start with the equipment, with the kalim. After all, we know that any time a pot or equipment is used to produce something non-kosher, so that equipment becomes non-kosher as well. If then you produce beer on equipment used for non-kosher beer, so then your kosher beer just became non-kosher. So the question is very simply, if you have an unflavored beer, which may have been produced on the same lines as a non-kosher beer, what is the status of that beer? So we've been doing tremendous research on this topic for many years now, and we have determined that, in fact, it really depends on the type and the style of the brewery which is producing the beer. And we've discovered that the large companies, whether it's a national company, international company, those types of companies are more traditional. And they generally tend to produce classic-style beers without any kosher concerns whatsoever. And even if they would produce a non-kosher beer, the quantity of beer which they produce, which is so large, we could certainly assume that even if they were to make a non-kosher beer, that the minimal amount of tarfas in there would be bottled. The question really comes into play is with the small breweries.
Can I interrupt that?
Sure.
Why wouldn't you have a problem with the defanis of the kalim, like you would have, let's say, like you wrote in your book, in your sefer about sherry kisks, with the defanis, because there is a din of kivush here too, that they keep them, I'm not an expert in beer, but let's say assume they keep it for 24 hours, and if what you do, dear, you would have sheer daifin, and then you would have the same issue again of kidei blias, and same issue that you would have with the shach, and you would ask there, why wouldn't you have the same issue with beer?
Oh, great question. So let's just get a little technical here. There are two points at which flavorings could be added to beer. They could be added directly to the brew kettle, and that's really the beginning of the process of the beer production, where they brew and they really cook up the malted barley, and they really cook it in boiling for 60 to 90 minutes. At that point, it's hot. Everything is hot. If they were to add oysters at that point, then the brew kettle would be completely trace. However, it's in the larger places, they generally don't add the flavorings at that point. They can add it later on in the process. And that would be either into the fermenters where it sits for many days and weeks or even months, where it's completely cold. And you're correct, there could be an issue of kavush at that point, because even though it's cold, but it does sit for 24 hours. However, we have generally found that the larger companies don't even add it at that point. They add it after the beer is completely ready for consumption. They add it directly right before the bottling point, right before they put it to bottles or cans. And at that point, there's absolutely no heat. It's cold. It's less than 24 hours. So at that, since we can assume the larger companies, just by their method of production, they add it later on in the process, it really doesn't affect the kalim at all. So that's with regards to the larger companies. When we move on to the smaller companies, here's where it gets really crazy. These small breweries, the craft breweries and the microbreweries, they're making anything complete tarfless, and in fact, they specialize in that, and they got to stick out and do something really crazy and unique. And these places not only deal with real tarfless, but we have discovered that they're actually adding it very early in the process. Very often, they add it directly to the brew kettle, and that would make a trace due to the heat process. They could add it to the fermenters, and that'll make a trace due to the kavush, even though it's cold, it's more than 24 hours. And then you have serious issues of kalim, even the unflavored beer, which looks like it should be kosher, but if it's produced in the same equipment used for non-kosher beer, then you just compromise the status of that presumably kosher beer.
Now, why wouldn't it be an issue, though, of nice and tam lefgam, like a person who buys a regular bottle of beer does not want to have the flavor of clams in their beer? There would also be the issue, possibly, that if it's after 24 hours, it would be also nice in tam lefgam. Additionally, you also have very possibly that it would be kidei klipa. Well, it wouldn't be kidei klipa, but even if it's kidei daifin, the steel is very thin, so it could be possibly batel b'shishim. You also have another issue that you would have to deal with the fact that you have, since these are made in such large masses of shefa, I mean, you have a lot of sfeikas you have to deal with.
You sure do. You're 100% right. There's a lot of issues to do with. So let me go deal with them one by one. Do we have the right to assume that it's Eina Ben Yoimeh? And that your listeners surely know that if a pot absorbed treif and sat empty, dormant for 24 hours, so then we assume that the ablius absorptions are somewhat compromised and they can't affect the status of anything going in that pot. So here's the question. Do we have the right to assume that the equipment has sat idle for 24 hours? And from experience, we've seen that in companies, in generally in the manufacturing business, very often they produce 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and they always are running, and they, in fact, don't let the equipment sit for 24 hours. So if we were to know that that a company which uses it for trade let it sit for 24 hours, then we certainly would have that heter. But as a general practice, we don't assume, in manufacturing at least, that it's sat idle for 24 hours, and therefore we don't have that kula of Eina Ben Yoimeh. The last point you mentioned was with regards to bittel. Do we have the right to say that it's bittel? So obviously here we're dealing with a situation of bittel b'shishim. We would have to know that it's bittel b'shishim. The general rule is, like you said, is that we generally assume that the contents of a vat is not shishim against the walls. That's a portion of many paiskim, that we don't assume you have shishim.
If it's hot, if it's cold, it would be they kleep, it would be more kal, but if they're doing it in a hot pot, it would be more problematic.
Exactly. So we generally don't assume that you have shishim, and especially these small places, you know, they're not necessarily doing large, huge batches, and if we just don't assume that you have shishim. So it's a very serious concern. You don't have bittel. It was added in a hot process or a cold coverage process. It's not a Ben Yoimeh. I'm sorry, we assume that it is a Ben Yoimeh, and then we have a serious issue. There's one more point to consider here, and this is a common question you get, is don't the companies clean the equipment between runs? I mean, if they're producing an oyster stout, they want the oyster flavor, but if they're producing a standard IPA type of beer, presumably they don't want that style, so don't they clean it out? So isn't that considered a koshering? That's a common question we get. And the answer is yes, they definitely clean it out. However, the cleaning that they do is generally to get rid of the pathogens and allergens. And we have seen firsthand this type of cleaning is only done at low temperatures, generally in the range of 145 to 160. So those temperatures certainly don't count as a koshering. So even though it's clean from their perspective, but from a kosher's perspective, it wasn't considered a koshering. So here you have it. You have these small places which are doing all these types of creative beers, and they could certainly be doing treif. And on the very same lines, they could very well possibly be making unflavored beers, and the consumer will never know. So at this point, we're faced with a dilemma. How do we deal with this? And the criteria that we designed was in the CRC is that the large companies, national, international companies, their unflavored beer is assumed to be fine. Because even if they were to make treif, first of all, we'd probably know about it. Second of all, they probably wouldn't do it. And third of all, even if they would, it's probably going to be bittel. As opposed to the small companies, the microbreweries and the craft breweries, even their unflavored beer should be avoided out of these concerns of kashrus on the same shared equipment lines.
Now, let me ask you, how do you deal with, at the CRC, the issues of Chametz Sha'avar Olava Pesach with breweries that are owned by Jews?
Yeah, that's a great question. We were actually shocked to discover a year ago a very large company out in California, very, very popular company, and if I said the name, I'm sure your listeners would recognize it, is owned by a Yid, and he doesn't sell us Chametz. And we actually approached a Rav in the town. He actually worked with him to try to sell his chametz, and at first he was agreeable, but then he decided he's not going to do that. So this very large company now is owned by a Yid who doesn't sell his chametz, and that creates very serious
issues. I mean, can you share? Is it a secret?
You know, it's on our website. It's on our liquor list amongst the names there, and your listeners, readers, will certainly recognize it. And we tried working with him for a long time. Numerous agents we sent him to try to sell his chametz, and he just wasn't agreeable. Now, but here's the question. Beer doesn't age very long, right? I mean, unlike liquor, which can age for years, beer, you know, it takes a month or a couple months aging process. So the question comes, can we assume, like, let's get at a given time after Pesach, that at that point any beer which the company produced and stored over Pesach is now off the market? Maybe at this point we can say, hey, you know, the company didn't sell their chametz over Pesach, but now it's gone. Do we have the right to assume that? So the answer is we discovered a very interesting angle over here, and that is, as we mentioned, one of the primary ingredients of beer is malted barley. Now, malted barley is definitely a chametz ingredient. And large companies, especially this one, they were receiving malted barley in huge quantities by rail car, and they have huge storage tanks of malted barley. So any malted barley which this company acquired over Pesach or owned over Pesach is now chametz she'aval on Pesach. If they were to use this in future batches, that would also be chametz she'aval on Pesach. So the clock starts much, much longer than we originally had thought. And therefore, even if a beer was produced after Pesach, and we know that for a fact, but the malted barley used in that production was likely owned by the company over Pesach, and therefore anything which they produce will be chametz she'aval on Pesach. So, you know, it's a very long range of time. Maybe like right now, like in a month or two before Pesach, we can assume that a standard beer is okay, but, you know, it's so hard to know, and therefore it's just something to stay away from. So we have almost on our website, on our liquor list, CRC liquor list, has not recommended all the varieties out of this concern. So this is an example of a large company which may not have kosher issues per se, but they do have the issue of chametz she'aval on Pesach, a very interesting development.
Now, another issue you could have with beer that is chadash. Wouldn't you have that issue with beer then?
That's a great question.
For those who are makbid on chadash, right?
That's correct, yeah. There are makbid on chadash. As you know, that Rabbi Herman puts out a fantastic guide to Yashan, and he does have listed there some companies when they actually switched over to the barley, which was chadash, which is chadash, and therefore he does list some dates there. So those who are makbid, they could either use those dates in the guide, or, you know, there are various satarim that people rely on the fact that it's turned into a drink or things like that. I'm not sure how strong those leniencies are, but some do rely on that.
Let me ask you, let me go to bourbon. Very few bourbons are certified kosher. Are there any issues? So let me just make a sikkum. On beers, you say most of the large breweries are not problematic. On the microbreweries that do produce non-kosher beer, it is problematic because we just don't know what is the status of the kelim when they are producing kosher beer. Well, so let's move on now to bourbon. Are there any issues with bourbon?
Okay, that's a good question. Now, bourbon is regulated by the American government, and the ingredients that they use are all kosher. So that's the good side. The problem is there's only one issue, and that is that there's a very large company in Kentucky, very well known with very famous labels, that is owned by a Yid who also doesn't sell his comics. This is a different
company. Can you tell us who it is? I mean, if it's these are you can internet everything, so why not just make it easier for our crowd?
Right. So this is actually listed on our liquor list. Let me just tell you some of the famous names. We do have it here, like Buffalo Trace, for example.
Buffalo who?
Buffalo Trace. It's a very famous one. Uh-huh. So that would only be recommended if it was purchased before Pesach in 1992. And that's at that point that it became owned by a Yid. Another very, very famous label is the Van Winkle family, whether it's Pappy Van Winkle,
Is owned by Jews?
That is correct. It's owned by a Yid.
So it's all chametz she'aval on Pesach?
That's correct. And
wow,
here,
but isn't it made out of corn, though, bourbon?
Oh, that's a great question. So according to law, bourbon has to be 51% corn. The rest of it can be from anything you want. And as a general policy, bourbon is not going to be 100% corn. Then it would be called something called corn whiskey. So the other 49% is generally made up of barley or even wheat or rye, but it's definitely a chametz.
So you're saying that Pappy Van Winkle whiskey is chametz she'aval on Pesach?
Unless it was purchased before the year 2003. Anything?
So who is he buying Pappy Van Winkle before 2003, I ask you? So you heard it here, guys, first. Pappy Van Winkle is chametz she'aval on Pesach. Wow. Let's give us another one.
Yeah, well, those are the famous ones. There's some more. We have our list on our list. Very
so why do kosher liquor stores carry it then?
That's a great question. I'd be surprised if they would. They definitely shouldn't be selling it. Unless they actually happen to have purchased it before the year 2003. So if they have an old stock...
Now, Chodesh Shavuot of Pesach is not... I'm sorry. Chodesh is not an issue by any bourbons or scotches because none of them are sold the same year that they're manufactured. That's fair to say, right?
That is correct. I mean, they definitely... Scotch, by law, has to be 3 years old. And bourbon... can be less, but I've never seen a bourbon less than 2 years. It just almost doesn't exist.
So I would venture to say that most people have drank Pappy Van Winkle, have not been aware of this. Let's go to other liquors. Can you tell us what other liquors, gin, rum, tequila, are there like surprise little bomblets out there that people are not aware of?
Okay, good question. So let me just give you a little background here. Back in November, we chaired a meeting of the ACCO Liquor Committee. It was done in New York, and it was a meeting of all the greatest whiskey experts in the kosher world. And we got together and we discussed those products which you mentioned. We discussed tequila, rum, and gin, and Canadian whiskey. And we decided, you know, there's so much information out there. Let's all get together and try to determine Haderech Asher Yelchuba. And we came to some very, very interesting developments. Well, your listeners are surely aware of tequila. Tequila is made from the agave plant. And it used to be, until 6 months ago, we differentiated between the various grades of tequila. There was the Blanco, Oro, Reposado, and Anejo. Those are different styles and classes of tequila. And we got together and we determined that really the conscious concerns of tequila are extremely minimal. There are very strong rumors that they add glycerin. Perhaps non-kosher glycerin to these, but we determined after much deliberations and investigations that concern is extremely minimal. So therefore, at this point, we have actually updated our liquor policy for tequila to say that all the classes are fine unless it's a flavored tequila, which is like an orange-flavored tequila, or if the label states that it was matured or aged in wine casks, you know, because that's the other issue of aging a wine glass. That's with regards to tequila. With regards to rum, a very, very similar thing happened. We used to differentiate between white, yellow, gold, or dark black. And again, we determined that really the kosher concerns here are extremely minimal. So therefore, we went all the way to Hakol and said that all classes of rum are fine unless it's a flavored rum or it's a spiced rum. Or it says on the bottle that it was aged in wine casks. So those were very similar guidelines. Unflavored tequila, unflavored rum are both fine as long as it doesn't say that it was aged in wine casks. Another situation where we went lacula was with regards to gin. Gin, as your listeners may know, is really a flavored vodka because it's really flavored with juniper berries. That's the primary way to make gin. So the question was, well...
And vodka as well. Vodka should be all kosher, is that correct?
So here we go. Vodka is considered kosher if it's unflavored, but you do have to look at the alcohol source. So, like, for example, you can make vodka from pretty much anything, from potatoes, you can make it from corn. Those are fine. Also from grain, but we have discovered very recently that some companies are producing it from grapes, from wine, from milk, from lactose, from whey. These are all kosher sensitive, and therefore it should be a problem. Like, you're not going to believe it. We found a number of vodkas, unflavored, they were actually distilled from grapes, to name a few, like Napa, Hanger 1. These are distilled from grapes, so those are non-kosher. But flavored gin does require hashgacha. So how do you deal with gin? Gin is a flavored vodka. So how do you deal with it? So after much consideration and deliberations, we determined that conventional gin from these large
gin is just vodka with juniper berries, not kosher.
Oh,
it's a vegetable.
Okay,
it's a fruit.
Excellent. So here's the point. When a company claims to use any types of spices or flavorings, very often they put in a little bit of spices because that's what they said to do, and the rest of it they supplement with chemical flavorings of spices. You know, they put in some droplets of cloves flavor or a ginger flavor, and that addition is kosher sensitive. That has kosher concerns. Any types of flavorings do. So if we were to know for a fact that a beer, for example, a beer only had whole cloves, that would be fine. What's the problem? The problem is, though, that they generally don't do that. They may advertise that they use real cloves.
Sir Rabin, could you give us an example of something that you know? Like, we have a lot of women that listen. Give us an example. Tell us of something. You're making a simcha. Here is something you may not be aware of, and it's a smoking gun. Got Rebbetzin's out there. Here is, you're making your simcha. Here is something you don't know. You should not be serving X. What would the X's be?
Okay, that's a great question. Well, you know,
give us some practical advice. We know now, Pappy Van Winkle, it's Usser. Give us a few more things.
Right. Okay, let me just say a couple beer companies, which you should stay away from, and consumers just don't know. Whether it's due to flavorings, whether it's due to tarfas, whether it's due to Chamash Alva Pesach. So just reading from the list here, some famous ones. For example, we had calls all the time about Victory Brewing. That company has produced non-kosher, and you stay away from it. Sierra Nevada Brewing Company out of California, that's another company to stay away from. Shock Top.
Sierra Nevada, wow, you see them in Wada Shalom Zachas. Another one.
That's correct. Shock Top, I've seen many places, and those are flavored beers. So they may be kosher, they may not, but we don't recommend
Next.
That because... You never know. Exactly. So those are some of the famous ones.
What about liquors and schnapses or gins? Give us some of those that you would stay away from.
Okay. So we just did recommend update our gin list, and I'm happy to say that we now do recommend Hendrick's gin. It's a very popular one.
What's us there? What shouldn't we be using? What shouldn't we be putting out?
Let's see here. Well. You know, this is too many to say. I mean, our liquor list is now 24 pages.
But what would surprise people? What would you say? Here's one that people use and they shouldn't be.
Well, let's see if we can find any more good ones. Okay, very popular one, Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey. We get lots of calls of that. And consumers want to know the cash of that. But according to our research, that is not recommended
because
it's a flavored whiskey.
And what does it have in it that could be problematic?
Oh, it has honey. So here's the point: if we know for a fact that they only put straight honey, that would be totally fine. But since we don't know, are they really using real honey, or are they using honey flavorings? So that would be an example of something which we would stay away from. Now, we were informed that this is available in Eretz Yisrael under Hashgacha, and apparently that's a special run. So if someone gets it there with the Hashgacha on the label, that would be fine. But to purchase it in America, that would not be okay.
Rabbi Neal, so if somebody wants us to reach out to you, do you answer questions? Do you take calls?
Absolutely.
And how would they do that?
Okay, they can email us directly to info@crcweb.org. And we will definitely address that. And I do recommend that consumers look at our liquor list. As I said, it's over 1,500 products. It's 24
and if they wanted
long.
To call you?
Let me give you our number, 773-465-3900. And we do answer questions all the time about various liquor products. But I just want to end off on one note, and that is that liquor is a very passionate subject to many people. And you know,
which I find amazing, because I remember as a kid, you know, Yidden didn't drink a lot. My father, Chan Levracha, used to say, "Mika Amcha Yisrael, the whole Kol Yisrael, together drinks like Goy Echad Ba'aretz." You know, ain't Goy can drink if he gans Kol Yisrael, but today it's changed, right?
Today it's changed, and the people are looking for specialized products. As you know, just looking at the wine industry, how it's changed from your standard Concord grape to wines produced all over the world. You know, people's palates are improving, and they're looking for better things. And with that comes along the kashrus concerns. And consumers are often surprised to hear that a product which everyone drank yesterday or last month is now questionable. But consumers should realize that it's a very complex market, and things change overnight. And things which were good yesterday, today are questionable. And it's really one of the last frontiers in kashrus, things which we do drink and consume without certification. I mean, who would take a package of cookies and eat it without hashgacha? No one. But now when it comes to liquor and beers, etc., now all of a sudden we do it. Now there's a precedent for that, and if things stay the same and simple, we're fine with that as well. However, it's definitely preferable to get products with hashgacha, because industry standards are always changing at all times, and you really don't know for a fact that the products that you're drinking as a from Yid, is it really kosher? Something to think about.
Well, thank you very much. That was the number one expert in alcohol kashrus in America, Rabbi Akiva Neos. It's an honor to have you on the phone, Rabbi Neos. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kof.
All the best, Kulta. So before we close, I'd like to share with you one last beautiful thought, and I heard this from Rav Hutner years ago. You know that you're not supposed to go to somebody's house uninvited. It's unpolite. Even though, you know, Obama lets people into the White House, supposedly. They have those crashers who showed them the fake invitation. I think it's out on it. If you show us your birth certificate, we'll show you our invitation. Notwithstanding, it says, Vayikra el Moshe, even the Avi HaNeviim, Moshe, who called Shvil in the Rakia and Hirinle, he wasn't allowed into the El Moshe that he built without permission. So you're not allowed to go in uninvited. And yet, there's an exception. Esther goes in to the house of Achashverosh at the end. She says, "Ze shloishim yoim lo nikresi al hamelech." 30 days I wasn't allowed into the room of the king. And what does she do? She goes to the uninvited. Rav Hutner says that the Baalei Avodah say that even the uninvited are allowed to enter the king's chambers on the days of Tainus Esther or Purim, which means, certainly I could speak for myself, I don't know if I could speak for you, people who maybe don't get invited into God's chambers, they can come in and say, yeah, where's your invitation? You know what? Esther set a precedent. Even the uninvited could come to be mespal of the Melech Malchei Amlochim, the days of Purim. Now, why am I telling you this? It's after Purim. But let me share with you something. The Mechaber, the Shulchan Aruch, I think it's at the end of Tafresh Pei Vav, in that neighborhood, sorry I didn't prepare that, he says that there are those who fast Baha, Beis Hei Beis after Purim, the Monday, Thursday, and Monday after Purim, in memory of the 3 days that Esther fasted. Which means those 3 days, that means this coming Monday, Thursday, and the following Monday, are sort of like mini Tainus Esters. Which means if you have something special that you really want to pray for, that you want to be mispal for, and you feel that you don't have like an entry card, and you would like to get into the White House to speak to the president one-on-one, but how do you get there? You're not the Secretary of State. Even she needs an invitation, or he needs an invitation. But you know what? If you're Makabel Tainus, and you say, you know, for me, this is going to be, I am going to accept what the Shulchan Aruch says, that this is for me also. I am going to sort of play sisterhood with Esther, and I'm going to, those 3 days are my Tainus Esther's too. So then you could also come, Avoy El HaMelech, even though Leinikreis, even though you were not called in front of Melech Malchei Melechem, great opportunity to get our tefillos in Skabel. May all our tefillos, may all your tefillos be answered. This is David Lichtenstein, Headlines Radio. I look forward to speaking to you again next week.